a new study this morning, and this study is on the book of James, but it's the material that I'm going to be using in this, besides the scriptures themselves, is a new book that Tommy South has written called Uncommon Sense, The Wisdom of James for Dispossessed Believers. And he's done a really good job in presenting this study on James, and so I'll be using that along, like I said, with the scriptures in putting together this material for our study as we go through this. I think it's going to be a really good study together. James has an awful lot to offer us for today, and you know, as you look through all of the different books of the Bible, and I think all of them are relevant to our lives in one way or another today. But James is one of those books that it has some very specific and very particular relevance to us. In other words, some of the books of the Bible, we read through them, we can, you know, kind of glean some things here and there, examples of things and so forth on how we can use them. And all, but James is very special in that in a lot of ways you can look at it and see how not only did James, what he wrote, specifically apply to his audience that he wrote back when he wrote it, those that were alive then, but it specifically applies to us today. In other words, it could very well have been written specifically for us today. In other words, even if it, you know, it didn't, wasn't written until today, in other words. You understand what I mean by that? So it's a very, very applicable book for us in our lives today. But James wrote this book probably sometime in the mid-50s A.D., okay, is when it was most likely written. One of the things about James that's so special in this that I think makes it even more particularly applicable to us today is that James is writing this, he wrote this work from a perspective of what is called wisdom literature. Okay? In other words, it's, there's a lot of wisdom that James shares with us about how to live and how to apply Christianity to our lives today. And so it's written in that form of literature, wisdom literature, that's in a lot of ways it's kind of like, you know, the Proverbs, which are wisdom literature. There's a lot of good advice in there. A lot of good things that if we would follow those things would draw us closer in our relationship with God. So it's written from that particular perspective. Tommy has this to say in the introductory material to his work here. He says, "I can't imagine a greater or more important theme for readers today who live in a world that seems almost totally devoid of wisdom." Okay? So James has given us a book of wisdom for us today, and again, I think this is one of the reasons why, as I said earlier, it is so applicable to us today, because it is about having wisdom to live in a world that doesn't have a whole lot of wisdom. If you think about the things that are going on in the world today and decisions that are being made by people in position to make these decisions, you say, whether you're talking about you know, federal government, state government, local government, school boards, all of those kind of things, how much wisdom, or should I say lack thereof, is being shown in a lot of the decisions that these folks are making that affects a lot of people's lives? No? Does it, school board in Lincoln, Nebraska, just last week they came out and were talking about they have this new format in the school system there where they no longer are referring to boys and girls as boys and girls. They're taking all of that gender stuff out of the classroom, and they're referring to them in one of the statements that they have in this material that they're supposed to use. They refer to them as purple penguins. You know, gather all your purple penguins over to the carpet, you know, and so forth. But they don't line them up as boys and girls anymore. They're supposed to try to line kids up, in other words, as to whether they like skateboards or whether they like, what was the other thing, Cindy, you remember me telling you? Whether they like skateboards or something else, you know, a couple of different things that they can choose to, you know, okay, how many kids like skateboards? You line up over here. How many of you like, you know, whatever the other things were, and you line up over here, and one of the questions that somebody asks is, what if they all like skateboards? What do you do with them then? But it's just the idea of this, you know, this, let's take out all these things, because what we want to do is make sure that everybody understands that they're people. Say, they're not boys or girls, they're just persons. And you think, who comes up with this garbage? Okay, you know, California out there, they're passing laws to, you know, the gender laws to get rid of all the, you know, if you gender identity, you know, you don't identify as a boy, but you're really a boy, you identify as a girl, then you can use the girls' locker rooms, the girls' bathrooms, and everything else. You know, boys can go into the girls' showers and, you know, for gym class or whatever because they identify as a girl. And that's the kind of wisdom we have in our world today. Okay. And so I think that Tommy's point here is we look at the wisdom that James has to offer us. We need it in this world today. You see? James, as I mentioned a moment ago, he writes to us today as he did back then. Okay? In other words, you can take what James wrote, and if he hadn't written it back in 55 or by 55 A.D., if it was written, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago, it would be just as applicable now as it was back then and has been for all of those centuries. He's written to Christians who are dispossessed. Okay? Well, what does that mean, to be dispossessed? In other words, Christians who live on the fringe of society. If you think about the world situation concerning Christians back at the time of you know, 55 A.D., you know, 40, 50, 60 A.D., what was going on? Where did Christians find themselves in society for the most part? They were being persecuted. They were definitely on the fringe. You know, we talk about, you know, for instance, Christian worship today, and, you know, you go all over the world and there are cathedrals and churches, and, you know, and we have a church building here. Well, they didn't have church buildings back then. Okay. Part of the reason was that if you met in a church building, then everybody knew who was meeting there, and that was a great opportunity to gather Christians and persecute them. So where did they meet? House to house. They met out in the, you know, in places out in the woods or wherever they could gather in secret, in the catacombs, which were the burial places. For folks, they met. So, Christians at that time were definitely on the fringe of society. Okay? They were facing persecution or discrimination simply because of their beliefs. They were facing that persecution not only from, in a sense, you know, the Gentile world, the Romans, who were the power and the authority at the time, the ruling authority, they were being persecuted by the Romans, who saw Christianity as an affront to the Roman government and the authority of the government. One of the reasons for that was what? Anybody have any idea? The emperor was considered to be a god. Okay? And so now you've got these people coming along saying, oh, there's not but one god, and, you know, and the emperor's not it. Say, well, we don't like these people. Not only that, but they're practicing cannibalism. You know, they're eating the body and blood of their Lord, supposedly. That was a lot of the misconceptions that people had about Christianity and so forth, and celebration of the Lord's Supper and so forth. So on the Gentile side, that was the persecution they were facing there. They were also facing persecution by the Jews. And why was that? Why did the Jews want to persecute
them? They thought they were blaspheming.
Yeah, they considered Christianity was a blasphemy against God because it wasn't Judaism, you see. And so they were facing persecution all around simply because of their faith. We move forward from that particular time to our world today. Okay, and here in America, in particular, where we live, in our streets and neighborhoods and so forth, Christianity is no longer an asset, people. Not like it has been in the past. When this country was founded, it was founded on Christian principles. It was founded on principles as our founding fathers were guided by the scriptures in putting together the Constitution and the laws and so forth that we had in this country. But those guiding principles are being pushed aside today. Okay? Where it used to be, not too long ago, it used to be an asset to be a Christian in terms of for employers and things of that nature. Today, it is more of a liability because of the concepts that are being pushed and portrayed by certain segments of our society that are portraying Christians. In fact, there was a thing on, you know, yesterday, on the news about these, was that on CNN Fox News had the clip, but it was on MSNBC or one of those, I believe it was, where they had two commentators on there that were talking about Christianity and comparing Christians today to the jihadists and saying that people are a whole lot better off basically with the ISIS people than they are with Christians. Especially women, because, you know, Christians treat women so terribly, and that they're better off being, you know, having ISIS than they are with Christians. That's what's happening in our world today. Where's Christianity? So we are quickly, as Christians, becoming a minority. Okay? And there are a lot of folks who have particular agendas that they are pushing, and they are doing everything that they can to associate Christianity with hatred and bigotry and judgmentalism and those kinds of things. And so if you stand as a Christian on your faith for particular things or against particular things, then you are labeled as a bigot or a hate monger or whatever the case may be in that. Christians are losing their jobs and their businesses today in America Some of our military members are losing their careers, have lost their careers, because they have stood up as Christians in certain situations in their jobs against supervisors who are pressing issues and so forth. They have lost their careers, many of them, because of that. Our chaplains in the military right now are being marginalized. Okay. And that's America, where we're supposed to have freedom of religion in our government according to our Constitution. The First Amendment says the government shall make no laws prohibiting the free exercise of religion, but they're doing it every day. So we need the wisdom of James today in terms of helping us to understand how we need to live in this marginalized status that we have, and particularly how we can do that with the wisdom of God. And that's what James has to offer us. In other words, we have to live here. How do we do that? So that, first of all, we hold on to our convictions. Okay? And that we don't find ourselves just kind of being absorbed into the society and what the society is doing and wants and everything else. How do we hold on to our convictions, first of all? And secondly, in holding on to our convictions, that we are living in such a way that others see Jesus in us, okay, through their prejudices. So how do we live our life day to day, okay, so we're not, we don't lose our conviction in Christ. At the same time, people are able to see us. Whether they agree with us or not, they're able to see Jesus in our lives. Whether they falsely accuse us or not, they see Jesus in our lives. Okay? And that's part of the challenge that James lays before us. Tommy also has this to say in his book. He says, prepare yourself for some startling discoveries. He says, James says some things you may never have heard before, because the wisdom he offers runs counter to that of the world in which we live. But that is precisely why we need to hear it. Okay? So that's what we're going to be looking at in this study. We want to be able to glean some wisdom from James that will help us to be able to make our way in this world as it gets tougher and tougher to live at our faith. Okay? Any thoughts or comments on any of that? Yeah, the things that are going on in the world today, in particular in America, shouldn't surprise us. We shouldn't look at it as going like, I didn't see this coming. I mean, the Bible tells us it's going to be coming. Okay, the issue is not one of where we need to do everything we can to stop it. I mean, you're not going to stop it. Okay, it's not going to stop. It's just going to get worse. Okay. So the issue is not trying to stop it. The issue is, again, how do we as Christians live, under these circumstances? One thing that I'll point out to you is that if you go back throughout history and you look at when Christianity spread at its most rapid rate, when was that?
It was
Yeah, it was during the persecution, you see. And so it's really, in fact, there's a book by a fellow by the name of Leroy Eames, and he wrote a book called, it was a study on the book of Acts, and it's called Acts, Disciples in Action. And in one of the places, one of the chapters in there was when he's talking about the persecution, he kind of paints this scenario. He says, picture all the demons of hell gathered around this great conference, okay? And what they're doing is they're trying to come up with this idea or come up with ideas on how they can stop the spread of Christianity, this new faith that's begun and so forth. And so he says, here they're all gathered and they're, you know, one demon shouting out this idea and another demon shouting out that idea, and they're just throwing out ideas and so forth. And way from the back of the room, somebody hollers out, one of the demons hollers out, how about a really, really great persecution? And so Satan up there in the front says, who said that? And this demon way in the back raises his hand, and he says, come up here. And so this demon makes his way up to the front of the room, and Satan says to him, what's your name, Private? And he says, oh, well, I'm Private so-and-so. He says, well, you're General so-and-so now, you know, whatever his name is. And so he puts him in charge of this great persecution. And of course, we see, you know, the Bible tells us of the great persecution that broke out after the stoning of Stephen and so forth. And people are spread everywhere. And what does it tell us that they do? As people are spread everywhere, what's taking place? They spread the gospel everywhere they went. So Leroy Eames goes back and he says, now the demons gather back again together, and Satan says, where's that general that suggested this persecution thing? And he goes, here I am, sir. He says, sit down, Private. You know, that's how, you know, kind of a comical look at that whole idea, that's, you know, that's what happened. When the persecution broke out, Satan thought it was going to stop Christianity, but in fact it didn't. It spread it even more. See? The point being that we do not need to have a favorable government or a favorable society in order for us to live our lives as Christians. Now, it would be easier. Would you agree with that? Okay, it's so much easier to live as a Christian when everybody around you likes you, see, and they, you know, there's no opposition. But maybe that's the problem. Maybe that's the problem. It's become too easy. And so people have not been holding to their convictions. You see? And so perhaps maybe Satan learned something from that earlier episode. And I'll make it easy on you. Okay? How do I get people to let go of their faith? Just make life easy. Okay. And so I kind of look at it this way, that perhaps God allows for that persecution, is allowing for the persecution to continue, and probably will get worse, because maybe he wants to thin out the herd. We've talked about time and time again, survey after survey, 80 to 85% of the people in America claim to be Christians. Not possible. If 85% of the people in this country were Christians, then most of the stuff going on wouldn't be going on. Okay. So again, we just completed a study not long ago called The Christian Atheist. People who believe in God but live as if he doesn't exist. That's Christianity today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing that we have to keep in mind is that the Bible told us that this was going to be coming. So, again, it shouldn't be any surprise to us, okay? The Apostle Paul said that there will come a time when man will not put up with sound doctrine. Okay? That they will, he said, gather around them teachers who will say what their itching ears want to hear. Okay? And certainly that's what's happened to quote-unquote Christianity. That there are too many preachers out there that are telling people what they want to hear rather than what the truth of the Scriptures are. And that's why we have the condition that we do today. See? Right?
Another thing, so much of this stuff going on is you're living in a world of power.
Okay. Well, somebody once said, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And I think that's true. You know, and unfortunately, we have too many people that aren't standing for the Lord, so they're falling for anything and everything that comes along. And being led astray. Chuck?
Yeah, that's the only thing that satisfies me.
And so the real issue then becomes, how do we, in trying to be faithful to the Lord's Word and to live our lives and as He has called us to live, how do we, you know, maneuver ourselves in society, in the world? How do we live our lives? And that's what we're going to be looking at through this. One of the questions that we need to start out with, and we're just kind of looking at some introductory stuff today in all this. Well, we have the question we need to look at and consider: James who? Okay, if you look at the first verse of this letter, it just simply says James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. Again, James who? Who is this James who identifies himself only as a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ? What we see here is that this author is opening this letter in a way that indicates that he doesn't really need any kind of an introduction. Okay? In other words, it's like everyone then, at that time, when this letter was sent out, everyone knew who he was. Okay? So he didn't have to further identify himself as a particular one. He speaks with a particular authority. And not only that, but he speaks as one who expects his voice to be heard and respected. Things that this author puts in here, the way that he writes it, is authoritative. And so his audience recognized that, and again, would know who that James was. Okay? He speaks as one whose opinion would hold a particular amount of weight with his audience. So when he gives wisdom advice, it is with a particular authority and recognition of who he is by his audience that folks would go, okay, we need to pay attention to this. Okay? But again, the question remains, James who? There are four possibilities from the New Testament, four Jameses that are mentioned in the New Testament. And so that's where we really need to look to be able to identify who the author really was. Okay? So let's take a look at, as we'll try to go through this part today, and then begin with the actual text next week. Let's look at some likely and unlikely candidates, okay, of these four Jameses that are mentioned. The first one is James, the son of Zebedee, who is also the brother of John, okay? What do we know about this particular James from the Scriptures? Okay, the fisherman. What else do you know about him? Okay. When was he killed? You have any idea? Okay, exactly. The book of Acts, Acts chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, tells us that Herod had him arrested and killed with a sword. Okay? Hang on to that for just a moment. We'll look at a couple of other things. Hang on to that for just a moment. What else do we know about this particular James? Yeah, he's part of the inner circle of the disciples. He's one of the three closest of the disciples in that inner circle of Peter, James, and John. In Matthew chapter 17 and Mark chapter 9, Luke chapter 9, he's there at the Transfiguration with the others. He was also there in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus took those three, you know, a little bit closer into the garden with him and asked them to stay and wait while he prayed. Okay? He was also one of the two brothers whose mother requested of Jesus a special treatment for her sons when his kingdom came to be. Grant that one of these sons of mine sit on your right and one on your left in your kingdom. That was James. Okay, and his brother John. But then we go back to the issue of him being killed by the sword. When did that occur? Well, it can be pretty closely dated to around 44 A.D. Okay? Well, if James, the book, was written probably, as we said earlier, in the mid-50s, okay, then what does that do with this particular James? Okay? Couldn't be the one because he was already dead. Chuck? He did. Absolutely. So it's, you know, we look at this particular James and, you know, it's not in saying anything at all against him or what have you. You know, he had a very special relationship with Jesus, accomplished some great things for the Lord, and so forth. It's just that he was not the one who wrote the book. Okay? There's also a James, the son of Alphaeus. Okay? He's the other James that is listed as an apostle. Okay? He's oftentimes referred to as James the Less. Yeah. And the reason that he was referred to as that is because there's less known of him than there is of the brother of John. See? Doesn't have anything to do with his stature or anything else. We just don't know a whole lot about him. That's kind of like when you're looking and you're doing a study of the Old Testament, you have major prophets and minor prophets. What's the difference between the two?
Heard of than a prophet.
Yeah, there are the major prophets, you know, which are generally the four, you know, big ones that we typically look at. Well, are they more important than the minor? No. It's just that the minor ones don't have as much writings as the major prophets do. Jeremiah and Isaiah, Ezekiel, they wrote a bunch of stuff. But the stuff that, and Daniel, the other one, the stuff that, you know, Hosea and Micah and all the others wrote isn't any less important. You see, it's not minor information, it's just we don't have as much. And so James the Less, as he's referred to, is kind of the same way. We just don't know a whole lot about him. There's not a lot of information in here about this particular James. He's a possible candidate, but not a likely candidate, just simply because he's not very well known. Well, if you go back to what we were saying originally, what are some of the characteristics of this James in terms of, you know, finding out who he is as the author, is the idea of the authority that he had and how well known he was. He didn't have to identify himself, you see, because everybody knew who he was. Well, that probably eliminates this particular James simply because he was less likely to be recognized for any authority. Though he was an apostle, you see, he was less likely to be known for that authority when he himself was less well known.
Wasn't he once referred to as James the Younger?
Right, James the Younger or James the Less, same, you know, just depending on what translation you're reading. Right, okay. So probably not James the son of Alphaeus. James the father of Judas, okay, is mentioned in the scriptures. And there were, did you realize this, there were two Judases that were amongst the disciples, or the apostles, okay. And one of them is identified, Luke refers to him in Luke 6 as the son of James. Okay? He is, John carefully describes him as Judas, not Iscariot. Okay? So to differentiate this Judas from Judas Iscariot. All right? So the same way there were two Jameses, there were two Judases. But James, the father of this Judas, we don't know anything else more about him. Okay? He's mentioned there, we don't know anything else. We don't even know, for instance, whether or not he was a believer in Christ. But he's one of the four Jameses that are mentioned. And then finally we come to James, the brother of Jesus. Okay? And this particular James is the one that we know most about from the New Testament. Okay? Matthew chapter 13 tells us that Jesus had a brother named James. Okay? Paul verifies that over in his letter to the Galatian church, Galatians 1 and verse 19. In fact, Matthew tells us James had four brothers. And one of the reasons that that's significant is because there are still people today who would argue, in fact, there's a whole denomination of religion that argues that Jesus did not have any real brothers. In fact, they would say that when it says brothers here, that should be translated as cousins. They try to say that these who are designated as brothers of Jesus were actually his cousins. The problem with that is that there are two different Greek words for brother and cousin. And the word for brother is what's used there, not the word for cousin. And there's no reason to use the word cousin you say, to say that it was cousins when they weren't cousins. It says brothers, that's what he meant. They were brothers of
right.
Jesus. Okay? So then we go to then the question, real quickly as we finish up, asking the question, did this particular James have the authority and the recognition to write this letter? So much so that as he begins this letter and doesn't identify himself any further in this letter other than to say, James, the servant of the Lord Jesus Christ, does he have that kind of recognition? Or did he back then? Well, again, Galatians chapter 1 and verse 19, Paul there refers to the Lord's brother as an apostle. Okay? He was not one of the 12 original apostles. Okay? In fact, in our study that we just finished up on earlier, we were talking about the Jesus touch, and we looked at that point where the brothers of Jesus, including James, are telling Jesus to go and, you know, make himself known to the public and so forth. What did it tell us there about their belief in him? They didn't believe in him at that time. Okay? So he wasn't one of the 12 apostles, but he was an apostle after the same rite as Paul himself was an apostle. Specifically chosen by God, you see, and designated as that. But I think that probably, and I'll encourage you to go and read in Acts chapter 15. You'll find out a little bit more, and we're going to be out of time here. So we'll kind of pick up with this next week and finish this part of our study when we get into the text, where what we see is James is being prominent in what is referred to as the Jerusalem Council. Okay? So certainly James, of the four candidates that we have here, James would be without a doubt one who had authority, and not only had authority, but that authority was recognized by the church at that time. So James probably, he's the best of the four candidates, and he is the most likely of the four, say, to be the one who wrote this particular letter. All right? So we're out of time this morning. We'll pick up here next week. We'll begin looking at the text itself. So I'd encourage you to take some time and read at least, you know, a good part of the first chapter of James. And that's where we'll be next week. All right? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.